First case for argument this morning is Turley v. Rednor. Mr. Bai.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Chris Bai, and I'm pro bono counsel for the appellant Gregory Turley. Mr. Turley is an inmate in the Menard Correctional Center in Southern Illinois. He filed a pro se complaint in the district court that featured claims arising from a pattern and policy of lockdown that has lasted 3 years. The complaint alleges three main things: excessive confinement for total deprivation of exercise, deliberate indifference to serious medical conditions, and withholding of a monthly stipend without due process. He also raised a related conspiracy claim. Mr. Turley pleaded all of these claims with particularity, using factual allegations that put the defendants on notice of the claims against them. His allegations sufficiently stated viable causes of action, especially under the liberal pleading standard afforded pro se prisoners. And that is all that we ask this Court to find. The Eighth Amendment of the Constitution guarantees inmates the right to regular exercise. This right is violated when there is a prolonged restriction to the point that the inmate's health is threatened. As this Court has repeatedly stated, a failure to provide inmates with the opportunity for at least 5 hours per week of out-of-cell exercise raises serious constitutional questions. We have a failure here. Mr. Turley pleaded a longer cumulative lockdown period under more restrictive circumstances and causing worse health consequences than even many successful petitioners before this Court. When resolving confinement claims, this Court weighs several factors, the totality of the circumstances, to determine the degree of the deprivation at hand. Mr. Turley pleaded the following facts, fitting the factors that this Court considers in these cases: extreme duration of confinement, 534 days, including essentially 8 of the first 9 months of 2010, an indefinite policy of lockdown, not a one-time measure.
Well, the 2010 does strike me as different from the others. I'll tell you what I missed in your brief. You never try to put together a table showing when the lockdowns are alleged to have occurred. Figures like 570 days are completely useless. Once somebody's been in prison long enough, he's likely to have been in lockdown or solitary confinement or something else a good amount of time. We need to figure out whether there were any stretches that would arguably raise medical issues enough to justify further litigation. And your emphasis on the aggregate rather than on any particular block of time makes it hard to do that. Are there particular blocks of time that you think raise bona fide medical questions?
Yes, Your Honor. We submit that the entire time...
Skip that. I just told you that won't cut it.
Okay. In 2008, there was a stretch of, I believe, about 140 days, 72% of which was on lockdown. In 2010, there was a stretch of 281 days, 231 of which were on lockdown, including only 4 short respites.
That strikes me as more plausible. Now, do you have any medical literature which suggests what kind of recuperation time is needed between no exercise periods?
We haven't provided any to the Court as of yet, Your Honor, but at this stage of the game, that is not necessary. All that is necessary is what is pleaded, and Mr. Turley...
Yeah, well, I know. The question is whether what is pleaded states a plausible claim. The pleading covers the facts. Now you've got to persuade us that that's a plausible claim, and that really is a medical question. So have you looked at the medical literature?
We have not looked at the medical literature, Your Honor, but however, as Mr. Turley has pleaded, each lockdown made his symptoms worse.
Look, if you haven't looked at the medical literature, suppose the complaint said, for 250 out of 280 days, I was in a cell that was painted green. And the color green just drives prisoners to distraction and causes their nervous systems to collapse. Now, that, for all I know, that's complete baloney. Or maybe there is something weird about the color green. In The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the color blue was intelligent, right? But, you know, in our world, the color green is usually not dangerous. We would need some evidence to show that it was dangerous. But there doesn't appear to be any.
Yes, Your Honor, but this Court has not recognized any relief for prisoners seeking a claim for deprivation in a green cell. This Court has repeatedly recognized
The reason is because no prisoner is so foolish. But you're not engaging with my point, which is that we need two things. We need to know a narration of the facts, and you say the complaint narrates these at least for 2010. And then we need a reason to think that this is harmful. And the prisoner's own belief about medicine is not a good reason to think anything is harmful.
Yes, Your Honor. However, this court has recognized in shorter periods of cumulative confinement, the 16 months at issue in Antonelli, that even less restrictive circumstances there do plead a claim for excessive confinement. The court in Antonelli did not rule that Mr. Antonelli was entitled to relief. It simply ruled that he had sufficiently stated the claim for numerous stretches that were not specified, the longest of which was 49 days. We have stretches here of 79 days and 81 days. We have a 123-day period that was interrupted by only one period of release, and that period of release was a 5-day period in which Mr. Turley was allowed to exercise allowed to leave his cell for 1 hour per day in each of those 5 days. If this court is not convinced that Mr. Turley has pleaded a genuine question of exercise deprivation that is constitutionally significant, we ask this court to, in the very least, remand to the district court so that this can be considered by them in the first instance. But there are many factors in play here besides duration. As this court does, it considers many facts. Duration is but one. We also have an indefinite persisting policy, not a one-time thing that is over and done with. We have no legitimate penological reason for the lockdown. We have a cell size of 40 square feet, leaving absolutely no room for exercise, sweltering conditions, especially in the summertime months, due to extreme temperatures and lack of ventilation, and all causing severe and genuine health problems. Under the case law of this circuit, these facts plead a constitutional violation. Mr. Turley also carefully and completely pleaded that the defendants were deliberately indifferent to the risk of harm to him. In recent Seventh Circuit cases of Prudence Santiago, this court has allowed pro se prisoners' claims to proceed despite almost no factual allegation of how the defendants may have come to know of the inmate situation. And that is because such facts are inherently very difficult for a prisoner to provide or to obtain even without the benefit of full discovery. But nonetheless, Mr. Turley has pleaded facts showing the defendant's requisite state in 4 different ways. First, he filed 4 grievances targeting all the defendants here, raising all the issues relevant here, and asking for help. They were ignored. Second, he personally told defendants Creason and Sarawine that the confinement conditions were dangerous, that they were causing him and other prisoners to suffer serious medical harm, and asking them for help. They ignored him. Third, he alleged that several defendants placed him in segregation for the purpose of making him suffer, that they told him this when they were doing so, that they told him they were doing it in retribution for him filing grievances and to convince him to stop exercising his right to file grievances. And fourth, he has shown that the risk of harm was obvious. It was obvious that placing 2 human beings in a tiny, stifling cell for weeks and months on end could pose serious health risk. And this risk went from obvious to glaring when this policy led to another inmate's heat-related death. These allegations are sufficient to plead Mr. Turley's excessive confinement claim and deliberate indifference claim. Mr. Turley has also pleaded a conspiracy claim. Twombly, this claim need not contain detailed factual allegations, and Mr. Turley need only plead, quote, a plausible account of conspiracy. Mr. Turley has done so here.
I must say, I don't understand what 1985 has to do with this. Are there any defendants who are private rather than state actors?
I believe that they are all state actors.
You know, we have held in a decision that neither side cites that 1985 is entirely irrelevant if all the defendants are state actors. The only function of 1985 is to allow a combined claim against state and private actors.
Could Your Honor help me? What exactly do you mean by 1985?
That's the conspiracy statute. That's the conspiracy parallel to 1983.
Mr. Turley has pleaded a conspiracy.
Look at Fairley against Andrews. It's 578 Fed 3rd 518.
All right. We'll take that under advisement, Your Honor, and I will look into that. However, there are many defendants here. Mr. Turley has left open the possibility that there may be private actors, including union personnel.
It doesn't matter if you leave open the possibility. It only matters who you sue.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Turley has pleaded action against union entities, and he does not know at this stage of the game whether they are state actors, and he does not know whether the medical personnel are state actors, though he believes them to be. He's entitled to a little bit of discovery here to determine that. And if I may, I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Mary Welsh. I'm here on behalf of the party in interest, the Attorney General of Illinois. As we mentioned in our jurisdictional
Excuse me. Has the Attorney General been sued?
No, that's why we're a party in interest, or a non-party in interest, I guess. We were invited to
Invited to state views, but I assume you're representing the general interests of the state officials who have been sued.
Well, technically, Your Honor, since they haven't been served yet, we're not representing them. I suppose
you're not their lawyer?
I certainly
haven't filed an appearance in this case as their lawyer, but I'm
correct.
Puzzled by any suggestion that you are not actually their lawyer.
Well, Your Honor, because they haven't been served, they're not parties, and so
people can have lawyers even though they haven't been served.
Your Honor, had we not been invited to file a response, we wouldn't be here. As we pointed out in the jurisdictional statement in our brief, we question whether this court has appellate jurisdiction because, as the plaintiff has acknowledged, one of his substantive claims, the procedural due process claim, was never addressed by the district court. And because the district court did not address the merits of that claim, its decision lacked finality. And thus, this court would not have jurisdiction regardless to address this appeal, regardless of the district court's having entered a Rule 58 judgment. These things happen occasionally by mistake. And so the fact that the district court erroneously thought it was done with the case does not grant this court jurisdiction over this appeal. However,
what happened if they dropped that claim?
Well, if they decided to abandon the claim, then I think there would be jurisdiction, but it was addressed in the plaintiff's brief, and thus I believe they can't be construed to have abandoned that claim.
Counsel, what defect do you think is in the district court's judgment? The district court has entered a judgment that, for all the world, appears to be final.
Yes, Your Honor, but the fact that it didn't squarely...
Yeah, well, look, the question is there a final decision?
Correct.
If all the district court thinks it's got more to do, then there's not a final decision. If the district court, however, says, I'm done, but the judge forgot to mention something, then there's a final decision, but the judge has just committed an error. And on your view of finality, a judge could perpetually prevent appeal of his opinions by just refusing to address one or more of the issues in the complaint. That can't be right, can it?
Normally what happens when the district court omits resolution of a claim, the person who wants to appeal then asks the court to address that claim, files a post-judgment motion. But that didn't happen here. And I think this court has held innumerable times that unless the district court resolves all claims against all parties, then
the court entered a Rule 58 judgment which said this case is closed.
That's true, but that was an error because it had not addressed.
That's the distinction between a decision that is final but erroneous and a decision, for example, saying count one of the complaint is dismissed. Right, where count two remains pending. That's not final.
Mm-hmm.
But a decision that says final judgment entered for the defendants, case closed, that's final, but potentially erroneous. It's a pretty fundamental but very important distinction.
I confess, Your Honor, that I read the cases differently, that when the district court has omitted resolution of one of the claims, then this court has dismissed an appeal for lack of finality. But in any event, and in addition, not only did the court not address the one claim, but it also dismissed without prejudice most of the lockdown claim. When a court dismisses a claim without prejudice, that is not final, as this court held. As this court held in a case in which plaintiff was a defendant, as we pointed out in our jurisdictional statement. But in any event, if the court decides that it does have jurisdiction over this appeal, plaintiff failed, as the district court found, to sufficiently allege an Eighth Amendment violation with regard to the lockdowns in particular or the cell size in general. The lockdowns, what plaintiff is alleging is that, first of all, as the court pointed out earlier, the plaintiff tries to aggregate his lockdowns, and as this court explained, you can't aggregate lockdowns. You have to address.
I don't know why not. The question, as I said to Mr. Bai, I should think is a medical question. Suppose there's good medical evidence that if you have a prison on lockdown and people get no exercise for 40 days, and then you allow exercise for 2 days, and then there's no exercise for 40 days, mm-hmm. then there's exercise for 2 days, then there's no exercise for 40 days again, that is, from a medical perspective, the same thing as 120 days without exercise. Now, that may be true or it may be false, mm-hmm. but it's not a legal question, it's a medical question. So what do we know medically?
We don't know any.
This is a pro se complaint, counsel.
Right.
Have you considered that at all? I haven't heard anything said about it so far.
Certainly, Your Honor, we did acknowledge in our brief that a pro se under Erickson, even subsequent to Twombly and Iqbal, that a pro se complaint is given a certain amount of leeway with regard to the allegations, but it can't escape the sort of threshold that, as the court noted earlier, there has to be enough to bring a plausible claim against the defendant.
What's implausible about this complaint? It's eminently plausible to me.
Well, under the case law, there seem to be sort of two strains of cases. One is the Pearson-Thomas strain, which says that generally if you have a 90-day lockdown or inability to exercise, then that's presumptively not cruel and unusual punishment. But on the other hand, you have the Delaney-Davenport line of cases that says that if you show both that you, the plaintiff, alerted the defendant to a risk of harm from you, and that you allege that you sought medical treatment for the medical harm that resulted in your injury, then you have stated a claim. And plaintiff hasn't stated a claim under either prong of or either line of cases here. And in addition,
well, this is an allegation essentially of a policy of improper lockdown or unjustifiable lockdown extending over a long period of time, is it not?
Well, yes, that's true. But in addition, even a policy of non-pedologically caused lockdowns would not state a constitutional violation unless you showed both that you alerted any particular defendant to a substantial risk of serious harm from that, and that you suffered this medical injury, and that you weren't allowed, you really could not exercise. And plaintiff says, I could have no meaningful exercise. Now, I'm not sure what that means.
That seems to be a fact that can be brought out later. It's not relevant to plausibility at this point.
Well,
how big is a cell, and can you do push-ups in it, and can you do pull-ups and so forth? We don't have to allege all those things at this point.
Well, no, Your Honor, I think you do. If he's saying the reason that this is a problem is that I can't exercise, I can't have any meaningful exercise, but instead he actually gives the dimensions of the free area, which is about the size of a yoga mat, and thus you can do, there is enough space. You can tell that there is enough space to do the sorts of exercises that were found to be enough to escape Eighth Amendment liability in Thomas Pearson and so on in that line of cases. So the fact that plaintiff alleges the conclusion that he couldn't do any meaningful exercise is defeated by his actually giving the dimensions of the space, which show that in fact there was enough space for him to exercise.
Well, I'm sorry, but those dimensions don't mean much to me. But go ahead, ma'am.
Right. Well, and the other thing about the exercise cases is that the lack of out-of-cell time is that the court has stressed that normally someone's in segregation and thus is in isolation, but here that isn't true. Even when, as plaintiff alleges, even when he was in segregation, he had a cellmate, and thus he was not isolated. And that's one of the primary reasons lack of out-of-cell time has been found to be unconstitutional in certain circumstances. But again, it's unconstitutional only in certain circumstances, such as when you're isolated for months, for months at a time, again, over the 90 days that Pearson creates a presumption against an unconstitutional lockdown. In addition, there you have to, as Delaney pointed out, if you show that you told the defendant, a particular defendant, that you had a problem with being either isolated or not being able to have exercise, and if you sought medical treatment, you can't just say, I have certain medical problems and they're caused by lack of out-of-cell exercise. That's your conclusion. You don't have to, on 12b-6 or on screening, PLRA screening, the courts don't have to accept a prisoner's conclusive.
You have to wait until the lack of exercise evidences itself in some symptom that you can go and go to the doctor about? Is that?
Well, yes. I mean, yes, exactly. That's right. You have to show that there's a risk to your health. And plaintiff says
risk to your health without an overt symptom of some disease, I think.
But but plaintiff doesn't show, as the court pointed out earlier, and doesn't show that there, with any factual allegations, that to be in lockdown for, and the court has indicated in its prior cases, Pearson, Thomas, and so on, that just being in a cell, particularly with a cellmate, for 90 days, and none of the lockdowns here exceeded 90 days, or even came close to 90 days. They were more in the, I think the maximum other than that was 70-something, that there would be a risk of harm to that with some factual allegations such as the medical ones that the court suggested earlier.
Did he have any factual allegations with regard to harm that befell him because of...
He alleged that he had certain medical conditions, arthritis, irritable bowel syndrome, a few other things, and he said these result from not having exercise. But he never says, so I sought medical treatment and this is what a doctor said. He's just self-diagnosing. And certainly that sort of conclusion doesn't state a plausible claim.
I don't know whether it's plausible or not. That's why I keep coming back to medical information. It may be that that kind of claim, that there is an injury caused by long periods in small areas, is well documented in the medical literature. How do we know whether it's plausible without medical information? I mean, the fact that Mr. Bai has one belief, and you have one belief, and the district judge has one belief, I mean, I think lawyers' untutored beliefs about medicine or science in general are not highly reliable.
I'm not disagreeing with Your Honor, but I would point out that the court has said in Pearson that a 90-day period outside, you know, without out-of-cell time is presumptively not an Eighth Amendment violation.
And the complaint alleges, at least for 2010, aggregate time in segregation vastly exceeding 90 days. It's something like 210 days, I think, in 2010, leading to the question whether, as a medical matter, those separate lockdowns in 2010 should be aggregated or not. And no one has apparently lifted a finger to do any research in the medical literature.
Well, Your Honor, as I understand the cases thus far in the circuit, the court has never addressed the notion of an aggregate. Even in Pearson, where there were four consecutive 90-day segregation.
Said, look, this guy is just stewing in his own juice.
Right.
He's misbehaved. No one can figure out what else to do about him. And if he's injuring himself, he's injuring himself. But as I understand the facts of this case, the lockdowns are not attributable to Mr. Turley.
It's true that, generally speaking, the lockdowns, he was in segregation due to his, you know, disciplinary segregation for 3 months in 2010. Yes, 2010. But other than that, you're right, Your Honor. But we also have to remember, Menard is a maximum security prison. There are many, I mean, not surprisingly, there are many.
Look, we have a federal prison. We used to have Marion. It was on lockdown all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We have Florence, Colorado. It is on lockdown 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. Those prisoners are not allowed out of their cells. I would be stunned if there weren't medical studies based on what happened at Marion and Florence that would tell us something about the medical effects of extended lockdowns. One has only to look. Anyway, thank you, Ms. Welch.
Thank you, Your Honor. We ask the court to affirm.
Mr. Bai, anything further?
Yes, please, Your Honor. First, to the jurisdictional issue, this is something the court has already resolved. The state has already moved before this court to dismiss this for lack of appellate jurisdiction. This court asked the parties to brief the issue. We did. This court ruled that there is jurisdiction and denied the motion.
Decisions of motions panels are always subject to review by the merits panel.
That is true, Your Honor, but there is jurisdiction in this case. The state points out, or the state says that the district court erroneously thought that it had gotten rid of all of the claims here. It did get rid of all of the claims. It said that this action is dismissed in full. This court has addressed cases numerous times where a district court has not mentioned claims, but has determined that if the whole decision is dismissed, if it's dismissed in its entirety, that's a final decision. The state has also said that Mr. Turley hadn't sufficiently pleaded constitutional violations. The state says that Mr. Turley cannot aggregate. Every case addressing this situation where we have multiple consecutive day periods has aggregated. That's what this court did in the Thomas case, and that's what this court did in the Antonelli case. Pearson does not support the state here. Pearson does not say anything of the sort that it cannot aggregate. Pearson addressed two arguments from the defendant. One, please, court, say that 90-day consecutive period is a violation, but in the alternative, please aggregate. This court undertook both analyses and determined that in both cases, the determinative factor was Mr. Pearson's misconduct. The state also says that Mr. Turley hasn't alleged sufficient facts to show a constitutional violation. The state stresses that Mr. Turley had enough room in his cell. Mr. Turley has a 40-square-foot cell. As he's pleaded, he has a strip of space between the bed and the wall where there's a toilet and a sink. This strip is 17 inches wide. That is not the size of a yoga mat, as the state says. My shoulders are 23 inches wide. That is not enough space for a person of that size. He's 5'10". I'm 5'11". On my best day, we're the same size. That is not a sufficient amount of territory for a person to lay down on one's back. You cannot do step-ups, sit-ups, push-ups, or even jog in place. The only thing you can do is stand flush against the wall and edge back and forth against the wall between the bed, the sink, and the toilet. This court rejected the exact same argument in the Delaney case, where the prisoner was confined in a 46-and-a-half-square-foot cell. Mr. Turley's pleaded 40 square feet, and has pleaded that there's no room to exercise. He's established the fact.
Were they bunk beds or beds side by side?
They're bunk beds. And this, the state puts a lot of emphasis in the fact that there's another person in the cell. That is not a relevant criterion for an exercise claim, except to the point that you have two people sharing 40 square feet. If it, to the extent that it's relevant, it's more indicative of a deprivation here. The isolation issue only has to do with the psychological burdens of being confined by oneself. That does not have anything to do with whether or not a person can exercise. As to the medical question, at this stage, at this gateway stage of the 1915A complaint review, all that the court considers all circumstances under the totality of the circumstances test, duration is but one. And this court and the district courts have addressed many, many times this exact issue of whether someone has sufficiently pleaded constitutionally serious health problems. And in no instance has this court thrown out a case for a prisoner's or counsel's failure to show medical evidence supporting it. What this court considers is the totality of the circumstances, including duration and including the ability for in-cell exercise. All that matters at this point, as this court has stated, is that he suffered a serious harm and that the serious harm is a plausible result of the facts that he pleaded. That is exactly what this court said in Delaney v. Detella. This court never undertook analysis of whether, in that case or in any other case, of whether sufficient medical literature supported at that time. He does not need to prove causation here. He does have to prove it before the district court at summary judgment or at trial. This is not a burden for 1915A review. Mr. Turley has shown under the totality of the circumstances test there is a deprivation here. The considerations that this court looks at are duration. Mr. Turley's pleaded it. 534 days and 2 years and 9 months, including 231 days out of 281 in 2010, which included two effectively 80-day periods of confinement and included a 123-day period with only a 5-day release of 1 hour per day. He's also shown that it's an indefinite persisting policy, not a one-time measure, not trying to get a benefit from something that bad that happened to him one time. He's trying to find some recourse to make his suffering stop. And if I may add one more sentence, Your Honor, he's pleaded no legitimate penological reason, no ability to exercise in his cell, sweltering conditions, and all causing sufficiently serious medical problems. He's used facts to do it, and that's all he must do at this time.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.